Welcome to the Democracy Convention. Nine conferences, one movement. Say it with me. Nine conferences, one movement. And we've had a heck of a convention. I want to know, I like to know who's in the house. I want to know, raise your hand if you attended a workshop or a plenary or a rally in these conferences. We'll start with constitutional reform. Raise your hand if you participated. Workshop, plenary, rally, all right. Democratizing defense. Did you participate? Woo, woo. Cool. Earth democracy. Oh, look at those hands. All right. Economic democracy. Boom. Education democracy. All right. Oh, we're getting around, aren't we? Local democracy. Media democracy. So important. Race and democracy. And representative democracy.
Yeah.
All right. All right. This is what America looks like. And we could look different, but we're working at it. All right. We want to begin with our keynote speaker. And I have the pleasure of introducing Deborah White Plume. Deborah is an enrolled member of the Oglala Band of the Lakota Nation and has lived on the Pine Ridge, South Dakota Indian Reservation all of her life. In 1997, White Plume co-founded a grassroots non-governmental organization called Au Aku. Help me.
Owe Aku.
Owe Aku. Bring Back the Way, to focus on social change work, cultural preservation, and Lakota Treaty Territory defense work. Since 2005, Deborah has been engaged in sacred water protection work through the Crying Earth Rise Up Community Education and Action Campaign. To challenge the world's largest uranium producer, Camco, Inc., as it attempts to open four uranium mines 30 minutes from the southern border of Deborah's homeland on the Pine Ridge Reservation. Let's all welcome Deborah White Plume.
Everybody in a good way. I come here in a good way. I want to tell you a little bit about myself and my beautiful Oglala Lakota people. To begin with, my colonized name is Deborah White Plume. My Lakota name is Wioea Ignanajimi, which means stands among the colors of the sun woman. This is my fifth name since I was born. When we're born as a baby, we're born as an individual. We're born into our tiwahe, which is our mother and father and brothers and sisters in the household. All the tiwahe living together is the tioshwai, the relatives living together. All of the tioshwai together make up the Oglala band. So the next circle is the Lakota Nation. The Lakota Nation, along with the Dakota and Nakota Nation, are inside what we call Ocheti Shakomi, which is the Seven Council Fires. The next realm of our existence, the seventh circle, is the universe. So inside those seven realms of existence, we have roles and we have responsibilities. We're not just born into the world. So as we're born and grow up, we're taught our roles and our responsibilities, first in the Tiwahe, then in the Teoshvai, then in the band, then in the campfire, then in the seven campfires, then in the universe. So as we progress through our life, we are given names. So I'm at the stage in my life now where I have a few more names coming, and then my time here will be finished and I'll go home. So when we're born, we have two ways of being. The first is our social way. Underneath that is the spiritual way. That's where natural law lives and comes from. So we call our mother Ina, which means mother. On a deeper level, Ina is breath of life. Ate is father. In a spiritual sense, it means the shoulder to lean on. Unji is grandmother, or the oldest dwelling. And Tunkashila is grandfather, or the oldest of my bloodline, and I love you. That's what it means. Woman is mwi. Women together is mwia. That means the stone that lives forever. Man is wichasha, the red star. So this is how we acknowledge each other in our Teoshvai, in our Tiwahe, in our band, in our nation, in our Ocheti Shakomi. So our relationships are very important to us. Everything about us is based on the kinship system. And that's how we live. That's how we live today among the Lakotas who still live as Lakotas. A lot of colonization has taken place among our red nations. A lot of our people have fallen away from Lakota way and have become basically Americans, and they live and believe in the Western society ways of life. But there are many, many, many traditionals at home. And my home is Pine Ridge. It's in the southwestern corner of South Dakota. And it's a reservation that is about 100 square miles. It's one of the bigger land bases retained by our ancestors through the making of treaties with the United States of America back in the 1800s. Now our nation retained this land base for us and our coming generations. Once gold was discovered there, then the military and the government and the churches got together and decided they would violate our treaty and open the land to gold miners. And so we've been faced with mining of our sacred Mother Earth since basically contact with the white man. Now, our people describe everything, like mom is breath of life. Little brother is Misu, which is the little braid we put on their hair so when they try to run away from us, we can grab them and catch our little brothers, you know, before they get into mischief. So we describe everything. And a long time ago, our Teoshvai was camped. It was deep winter, deep snow. Our lodge was halfway covered with snow. We were all inside, and we smelled something funny. So we looked out and we seen a man coming, and he had a lot of hair and a lot of hair. And he was desperately looking. He smelled something. He's smelling. And all summer, our women would work together in the Teoshvai. Any hunters among you out here in the audience, you know wild game doesn't have a lot of fat. Very little fat on the buffalo, on the deer, on the elk. So we would work together, all the Wea in our Teoshvai, to gather fat. And we would store it in a dried belly bag or bladder bag, and we would share it throughout the winter. It was medicine. It was used in our cooking. It was used to make fire. We had a lot of uses for it. It was very rare and precious. and valuable. And he smelled it. He was lost and hungry and thirsty. And he seen the bags hanging in the trees. So he went there and he pulled one down and he got his hand in there and he started eating it, stuffing his face. And he pulled all our bags down and he fed himself and he walked on. And so we call him Fat Taker. He took our fat, taker of the fat. He thought only of himself. He didn't think of anybody else but his own hunger. We can all relate to that. Maybe we can all relate to that. But that's what we came to call him. It was a description of his conduct. And he happened to be a white-skinned man. But it's a concept for greedy, selfish, self-centered people. We call them fat taker. Now, the first Italian man we saw had big, long feet. So we call him Sitonka, big, long feet man. The first German man we heard speak, he spoke harshly. Yashicha speaks harshly, man. The first Japanese we saw, we called him Ishtami Yudita man, ice pulled back man. So we describe everything. And so fat taker is not a description of the white race. It's a description of the kind of people who will take from others to meet their own need, not caring about the others. Now recently in America, there's been a movement about the 1%. Well, we knew about them a long time ago. We call them fat taker. It's basically the same thing. They take for themselves, even though it hurts others. So to our people, we were faced, first of all, with gold mining in our sacred Black Hills of South Dakota. That mine has been mined out now, and they left the deepest hole in the ground in the world for mining. So the American government, the science community got together and they have a science lab down there now. Way down there, they're constantly pumping water out because sea groundwater is in the ground. But they have a lab and they're studying dark matter down there. Against our wishes, just as the gold mine was there against our wishes. Even though we have the Fort Laramie Treaty with the United States, that was violated as soon as a valuable resource was found there. So our people have always been faced with the fat taker from the very beginning. And now people all over the world, even right here, are being faced with the fat taker. Those who want to run over you, run over your rights, have no respect for you, give no esteem to the integrity that you have for your vision of your families, your community, your town, your state, what you want to do with your lives, you're being run over, just as we were run over back in the day. So I understand how you feel. I understand what this conference is about. And my heart is with you. And I'm really thankful to you for putting this on. I'm going to acknowledge all the worker bees who made this happen. Without the worker bees, these gatherings don't happen. So I really appreciate all the sacrifices everybody made to pull this together. And it feels really good to be here. I don't like to leave my home. I live out on the land. We have horses, we have buffalo. There's elk and deer there. Right now is a gathering time for us. We have to gather cherries and berries and plums and grapes and all of these items that we will eat throughout the coming months. But my family's at home gathering, and hopefully they store as much as they eat. Because I'm coming home. But when you live on the land and you're of the land, then it's only natural that you love the land. And I was up here getting ready to love Wisconsin cheese and couldn't find any. We just found a store down the street, so we found some Wisconsin cheese, and I'm going to take some home to my family. And honey, we found some honey. So every part of the land gives to the people who live there, if you're willing to work hard to make it happen. At home on the Pine Ridge, it's a hard life. It's considered to be, since the census taking began in this country, the first, second, or third poorest county in America. That's where I come from. I talk to some people here who work with the poor and the homeless, and I can relate to that. At home, as long as we have land, we're never homeless. But there is a lot of economic poverty there. But relatives helping each other, that's how we survive. And if you really think about it, people don't need that much to live. If you really, really think about it and discipline yourself, and maybe take a 6-month trial, see what you really, really need to live. Your need list and your want list are gonna be two different things. We're trained, we're brainwashed, we're colonized, we're taught to shop, consume, shop some more, consume some more. Our house gets full, rent a storage unit, put your stuff there, because we gotta have stuff. We gotta have our stuff, we gotta have a place to put our stuff. So then we fill our house, we fill our basement, we fill our garage, and then we rent a storage unit, and we rent another one, and then we go shop and we consume some more. But if it's in storage, then you don't need it. I came to find that out. So no matter what our issue is, no matter where our passion is, no matter where our heart is, there's ways we can help each other. There's ways we can align ourselves to work together, to get strength from one another, and to comfort one another, and to give strength to each other. We all need that. The work that I do is very grassroots, very grassroots. I'm a mother, I'm a grandmother, I'm a great-grandmother. And I've been doing this work all my life, since I was 14 years old. We formed Oweaku in the late 1990s to serve as a vehicle to do this work in the outside world, which is anything outside of our territory. So we do work to, number one, preserve our beautiful Lakota way of life, teaching our generations to preserve it and to revitalize it among our colonized red nations, and to share it with the outside world so the outside world can understand us, who we are, how we feel, why we do the things that we do. Why is our land so important to us? Why is the freedom to speak our language and to have our religion so important to us? So we work to protect and defend our treaty rights. I said earlier, our people have a treaty with the United States of America through which we retained a land base and other rights. We work on human rights. Human right to water is a very important human right, and we're focusing on that for the last decade. And we're also doing a lot of work to share that information with the bigger world. As we grow up and have children and become mommy and daddy and get all caught up in that, then that's our focus, and it should be. It's the most important job in the world is to be a good mommy and daddy. But at some point you have to look outside the four walls of your home and look at the neighborhood you live in, the town you live in, the state you live in, the country you live in, the continent you live on. That's kind of like being an individual in the teepee, to the Tiwahe, to the Teochebaye, to the campfire, to the nation. It's the same thing. Now they teach us we have a responsibility there. We have an obligation there. We have a duty there, and it's a privilege as well to fight for these ways. And it is a fight. We worked 20 years at the United Nations to pass what's called the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. Why do we need that? We need that because America does not observe our human right to be Lakota. Now, several years ago, our way of life, our spiritual way of life, was a crime in America. It was the late 60s, early 70s, that the American government decided to decriminalize the sun dance of the Lakota Nation. That was in my lifetime. All our elders worked hard for decades, decades, decades. They came out here into the big world, made allies. Maybe some of your elders worked with my elders to make that happen. So in my lifetime, I saw a law change in this country, and they decriminalized our right to be a spiritual people. Before that, if we got caught, we could get put in an insane asylum where many of our people died, or we could go to prison. Yeah? So I know social change can happen. Laws can change. It happened in my lifetime. So we do this work. We go around, we share our beliefs, we share our way of life, we share a little bit about ourselves so outsiders can see us for who we are. There's a lot of racial prejudice in this country against what they call Native Americans. Well, we're not Native Americans. That title, along with American Indians, dehumanizes us. And it's a deliberate attempt to influence people's attitude towards us. We're the Lakota Nation. That's who we are. On a bigger level, we're Ochete Shakomi, historically incorrectly known as the Great Sioux Nation, which maybe some of you read a paragraph about in fifth grade. Sad but true, that's still the way it is in schools today. So we come out here to share that, and we call ourselves as a group Red Nations. Now, the American government had a hard time dealing with our traditional way, our traditional government. In the Teochebae, there are the headsmen or itacha of each Tiwahe. All of the Tiwahe together is the Teochebae. In the Teochebae, there will be a Nacha. Now, this might be a Nacha. Or he might be a Nacha, or he might be a Nacha. These are the older men who have lived a life of experience where they can make a decision. They're decision makers. But they make the decision collectively with all the itachas, all the men. Now, the men don't come to this gathering to make a decision unless they have worked this out with the women in their teepee. The women in their families, not just their wives, but their mothers, their grandmothers, their aunties, their sisters. That's how decisions are made collectively. And it was, I think, pretty good to have a consensus like that. Prior to the coming of the white man, we had what's called collective consciousness, collective memory. We all had the same experience. We all had the same environment. We all had the same social conditions. There was no homeless or poor people. Everybody hunted, everybody gathered, everybody prepared food. Can you imagine laying in your teepee all day, resting? And I'm gonna lay there and rest, so you go pick my berries for me. You pick my cherries and my plums, I'm gonna rest. And then you can dry them for me and package them, and then you can go bury them in the ground for me, and then I'll get them later when I'm hungry. Okay, yeah. See, that didn't happen, right? How could that happen when you all live together? Everybody has the same values and the same respect. To us, food is medicine. So is water. Water is our first home. We come here from the Star Nation to our mother's womb, and we live in water. When we're born, the woman who receives us prays with water and puts water in our mouth. It's our first medicine. We're bathed in sage water. All of this happens in the first few moments of our life. Most every part of our life is guided by ceremony. And to us, this is not a ritual. It's part of who we are. It was a gift given to us by the White Buffalo Calf woman who was sent here by the Creator to give us some ways to live good and good teachings. Every one of our ceremonies is related to a place on earth. Each one of these places on earth is represented in the Star Nation. Just like we live in Teoshpai, the stars live in Teoshpai. They call them constellations. So right now we're moving to a time where we're going to have autumn equinox. Our people will move to a place in the Black Hills called Matopaha. Representatives from each of the bands will go there and they'll have meeting, strategic planning. Who's going to camp where during the winter? Who's going to set fire to what land in the spring? Who's going to make war on who? Who's going to defend this territory? Who's going to defend that territory? Stuff like that, like a city council meeting, I guess. And then from there, everybody will disperse to winter camp. So during winter solstice, we have ceremony at a place in the Black Hills. We know where we're supposed to be on Earth. As the stars shift, we know we have to get ready to shift too. So then when it's spring, we will go to a place in the sacred Black Hills and we will have ceremony to welcome back the thunders, feed the birds, all of that. And then from there, we will spread out. And then at the summertime, summer solstice, we'll have ceremony at what's known to us, Matotipila, or Devil's Tower, and we have ceremony there. That's how our people gathered. When the stars moved, we moved. We know where these places are on Earth, and so we go there. Now this is who we are today too, but it's much more difficult for us because all the laws that were made in this country to govern this country do not observe our need to be who we are as a spiritual people. There's been times when we went to Matotipila and we did not fill out an application for a permit to have our ceremony. We took people, we surrounded the mountain, our men went up there to have their prayers, and we did a direct action and we resisted the state police, the county police, the National Guard, and we held our ground until our ceremony could be completed. And then we came down, and then we went home. That's a personal responsibility. Not everybody's willing to do that. I lived in the outside world here enough to get college educated in my younger days. I've always been traveling since I was age 17, taking this message out to America, all over Europe. This is part of what I do. So I know enough about this country to know that right now I'm lucky to be here with you all who feel the freedom in your heart to think the way you want to think. But for the most part, there's many, many sheep in this country. They just follow the law, they follow the leader, they do what they're told, they go shopping, they consume, they rent a storage unit. They have heart attacks, they get diabetes, they get cancer, they get sick, because that's not life. Now I'm not saying you gotta be a wolf, but I'm saying the time to be sheep is over. If we're gonna have a mother to live on, if we're going to have a Mother Earth to live on, people have to take that responsibility. They have to take that courage in their heart. They have to have that big mind, that free spirit to do what's right. Now, I heard a lot of talk over the weekend about creating laws. I believe a law that should be passed is the rights of Mother Earth.
Yeah.
That's right.
We have to have a law. For me, it's a real privilege and an honor to fight for Unchi Maka. Maka is my ancestors. Unchi is the oldest dwelling, Grandmother Earth. Unchi Maka, the oldest dwelling of my ancestors. I talked to you a little bit about the Star Nation. This morning was very beautiful here. Grandfather's breath in the sky is the stars. While on Unchi Maka, there's always something like that. At dawn, when there's fog on Unchi Maka, that's Grandfather's breath. It's a blessing to us, and it's a healing to us. So I was very grateful and thankful for that this morning. And then it turned into a mist, and then a sprinkle, and then a rain. And I was comforted by that. We know we can't live without water. There's substitute for gas, there's substitute for oil, there's substitute for uranium. There is no substitute for water. We have to defend our water. We have to protect our water. We're fighting Cameco Incorporated, a Saskatchewan-based uranium company that has one mine, wants three more mines, using 9,000 gallons of water a minute, every hour, every day, every week. They want to do this for another 30 years. We're saying no. We're fighting TransCanada's Keystone XL pipeline, which wants to cross our drinking water source 47 times, 2,000 and some rivers, lakes, streams, springs, the Ogallala Aquifer. We're saying no. Even if President Obama says yes, we're going to put our bodies in front of those machines. We're going to put our moccasins on the ground. They're going to have to run over us or throw us in jail to make that pipeline happen. Privilege to do that, it's our honor to do that, and it's our obligation to do that, because Unchi Maka, the sacred water, the beautiful Lakota way of life, doesn't belong to us, it belongs to our coming generations, it belongs to our children, it belongs to our grandchildren. And I know every grandma in here, you will fight for your grandchildren, right, grandmas?
Yes. Yes.
Moms, you're going to fight for your children?
Yes.
That's the way it is. And that's the message that we have to give to the bigger world, that these rights of corporations, they do not trump our rights as moms, as grandmas, as aunties. There's no way they trump our rights. And how are they going to know that? They're not going to know that unless we stand up and make our voices heard. Let's stop traffic. Let's get out in the streets. There has to come a time when an email is not enough. Letter to the editor is not enough. A vote is not enough. We've got to resist. We have to resist with our body, but with the love in our hearts. So I'm going to ask you all something. Resist. Resist with all the love in your heart. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Federal life loan. Federal life loan. Family, wasn't that wonderful?
Yes.
Yes. We asked, we're going to move into question and answer, and we asked that you be aware of this space in terms of how we do this. We asked that for your question that you limit it to 1 minute. You can do a lot in 1 minute. We want to do this so that democratically, as many of us can participate as possible. I want to introduce our facilitation team. Julie Burns Inslow will handle the microphone, and we'll ask that people stand in line in terms of creating a stack, a line, a queue from this point on. And also that the other member of our team, Amkar Sawar Dekar, he'll get more involved later on after this period. So can we do this?
Yes.
Thank you.
First, can we line up with this quest staff?
I'm Ellen Thomas from the mountains of North Carolina. And last year I had the good fortune to meet Charmaine Whiteface in Chicago. And she was speaking about a bill that she is working on with Defenders of the Black Hills to have a moratorium on all uranium mining until all of the existing uranium mines have been cleaned up. Are you familiar with this? And
yes, I am.
Could you say anything about that, please?
About the bill or about the abandoned uranium mines?
Well, both.
Well, we have over 2,000 abandoned uranium mines in Lakota Territory. And right now, one of the current strategies is to take a bill to Congress. That's not a strategy that Weaku is participating in.
Well, in a way, mine is the same question, because Ellen and I work on trying to get rid of nuclear weapons and the whole nuclear chain and the whole nuclear industry. And so my question is, well, I guess it's two parts. We know the Diné, the Navajo people, have banned uranium mining in their area, but the government keeps granting contracts anyway. So one question is, are you working with other groups of, you say I shouldn't call you Native Americans, but whatever you are, you're great. Are you working with other great people not to allow uranium mines? And then I've heard as much as 70 or 80% of the whole nuclear industry is on your land. So are you helping us, white folk, get rid of this curse on our land?
We have many allies that we're working to stop the whole nuclear chain. The whole nuclear chain will stop if they stop mining uranium. And that's been our message from day one.
Sandra Everett, my question's a little different. Throughout my life, you said how rituals for you aren't rituals, they're just part of who you are. And throughout my life, I've had the opportunity to participate in rituals, even once being privileged to attend a Sundance. And wondering whether when we do your rituals along with you, is that considered respectful, or, you know, like we're all working together, or is it an infringement on your culture?
Our teachings tell us that there's one ceremony that's open to the common man, and that's the sweat lodge, as long as it's run by a Lakota in Lakota territory. Other races can participate, but all other ceremonies are for the Lakota.
So we shouldn't be doing them.
Carl Hensness, can you comment on the Rainbow Warrior prophecy and how this applies to working together with all races here and globally?
The Rainbow Prophecy is not a Lakota prophecy, so it wouldn't be appropriate for me to comment on it. Maybe that came from another Red Nation, but that's not a Lakota prophecy. I'm not an expert on other Red Nations.
Bob Rushline, my question is, would you support this minimum wage White House petition? And I'll briefly read it and then give the website. Here's some more information about this petition. Increase the minimum wage to $15 an hour. In a new documentary, Inequality for All, featured Robert Reich, we find out that the average Joe income goes from $48,000 in 1978, down 30% to $33,000 in 2010, while the top 1% go from $393,000 to 1,100,000. The 8-to-1 inequality spread goes to 32-to-1. That's right, it quadruples in 32 years. Just one more sentence. The British book Spirit Level shows how this contributes to obesity, mental illness, murder, teen births, prisoners, and lack of social mobility among the 22 rich nations. This is a decay of empire, folks. It's correlation with long with military spending are even stronger. The new feudalism with lords and serfs. The website is whitehouse.gov, wh.gov/LRK, capital J, capital W.
I'll be glad to sign that. Our tribal government at home increased our minimum wage to $15 about 2 years ago.
Also, my Menominee name is Osawa Nemeki, and I'd just like to have a gift here for you for your words this afternoon. My granddaughter came to me a while ago and asked me to help her with this eagle that she had received, and there's some plumage here that I would like to share with you.
I would just like to say that I don't know how this conference opened. I don't know if it opened with the appropriate Red Nation people welcoming everybody to this conference. Did it start like that?
Yes.
That's
yes.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for doing that.
So first, I just wanted to say thank you for the work that you've done throughout your life. The mother of my children and I were split. Kind of different. One of the things she said to me recently, she called me and my current partner, she called us Indians, and she referred to herself as a pioneer, just in terms of describing the difference in our philosophy. And I didn't even really know how to respond to that, because to even make that statement and not realize what you're saying and all the implications of it was very challenging. And as I'm listening to you speak, particularly the message around mothers, like, I do this work in defense of our children, the planet that we're not going to have. And you know, her husband, her current partner, makes $120,000, and she lives in a nice house, and she has two big cars that eat a lot of gas, and she just sees this as a difference in philosophy and not as like a life-threatening thing. And I want her to talk to you, right? But not just her, but all of the mothers like her who are in their house with their big cars and think that their kids are safe. What would you, or how do we approach that, right? How do we approach motherhood as embraced in colonialism and capitalism, right? Which basically says, I'm a good mom when I buy my kids stuff. Like, how do we deal with that?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, greed is not a value. For fat taker, greed is a value. I don't know how else to end.
Deborah, thank you so much, and we have learned so much. One more time, Deborah Weiss-Kuhn.
I'd just like to make a prayer and acknowledge this gift.